Yes, so I've been living in Japan now for about 14 years. And originally I just went to Japan quite casually, just to work as a teacher. And I wasn't planning to stay so long. But the longer I stayed, the more I tried to find out about Japan, about the kind of things I'm always interested in, which is social history and aspects of underground culture. So obviously I was in Japan, so it made sense to start researching about that in Japan. I mean, it wasn't my original interest. I mean, I might have gone to another country and done a book about other countries' social histories, but after being in Japan for a few years, I started to look around and do some research, and I realized what a rich history there is in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and how there's some information about it, but really there isn't so much actually, and a lot of information was not so clear. So I wanted to try and clarify a lot of information for myself, and then I realized I could do it for other people as well. But now my background is partly history, but also literature and theatre. So I was focusing my research on underground arts movements, particularly performing arts, that I thought I would be my main focus. And so I was looking at people like Shuji Teruyama, who's a famous film director and a theatre artist. But then I realized I was as interested in the general social movement, if not more interested in that side. And gradually that became bigger and bigger, and the arts and culture section kind of became a section rather than the main thing. But yeah, originally my approach was a little bit different. I mean, I was born in the early 80s, so I grew up under Thatcher and then New Labour in the United Kingdom. It was a time when, the left in the UK was very much experiencing a decline, and it was the end of big ideologies, it seemed. So I didn't grow up with a strong sense of left-wing ideology because that was seen as the past. And so I think there was a kind of a absence there for me. And so maybe my motivation was partly because I lacked that history myself. I didn't have that kind of left-wing, strong activist kind of history in the 80s and 90s. And so perhaps I could look back to history and try to compensate for my own lack of experience.
So you were saying that your research had a focus on the 50s, 60s, and 70s. This is also the time we want to talk about. When we talk about 1968 in Japan, I think it's necessary to start a bit earlier, to start in the time after the Second World War. Japan was a monarchy, and it was one of the countries who fought on the side of Nazi Germany. What happened then? How was the political situation in Japan after the Second World War?
Yes, you're absolutely right. You have to take it back to the end of the war, because so much about what was happening at the end of the 60s has its roots in what happened and what did not happen after the end of the war. So what did not happen is that you didn't see a proper democracy suddenly appearing. You didn't see the Emperor Hirohito, who many people would argue has war responsibility for some of the things that happened in the war. He did not go to prison, or he did not lose his position as emperor. So none of these things happened. There was a glimmer of hope for a while that Japan might truly become a democratic country, and the Western occupying forces allowed labor unions, and they legalized the Communist Party and other political parties. And they gave freedom of speech again. All these things have been, of course, banned under the fascist period. But then, quite quickly, as the Cold War started and things in East Asia changed quite dramatically with China and Korea, the pressure was suddenly put on. And during the occupation of Japan until 1952, the things went in the opposite direction. And suddenly, what happened in 52 at the end of the occupation was a very conservative establishment was left in power. Many of the people who had been part of the war machine, the war government, were still in power in Japan. I mean, some people were put on trial, but many people were allowed to continue. one of the later prime ministers of Japan was, in fact, actually in prison as a war criminal for a while. So in many ways, after the war, this hope of a true liberal democracy or a kind of democracy as we might think of it today was lost. And the situation instead was this very strong conservative establishment and with a very strong American United States military presence in Japan. So very much Japan was included in the United States side of the Cold War right from the beginning. Lots of military bases, and Okinawa, the large prefecture of the South, remained U.S. territory until the 1970s. And so Japan was basically, although it was again independent officially, it was essentially a vassal state of the United States.
When we talked here in our radio about 1968 and other countries, we realized 1968 is nothing that came from one moment to the other. 1968 was the result of a longer process. And one part of this process was that after the Second World War, there have been a series of left-wing groups that was founded, the so-called New Left, groups that were looking for a new orientation beyond the traditional left-wing movement. You said that there, after the Second World War, some of the old left-wing groups were legalized again. Is there something similar to the New Left in Japan?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of parallels between what happened in Japan and what happened in Europe and America, and the emergence of the New Left is definitely a point we can compare. The situation is a little bit different in Japan, of course, so basically you have the old left, as we now think of it, basically the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, and the major labor union federations. So they were strong in the late 40s and 50s, and the Communist Party today exists and is still much of a very strong part of the Japanese Parliament today in the opposition. Quite quickly in the 50s, you see new types of activists and new groups emerging in direct opposition to the old left, particularly the Communist Party. And a lot of this comes from the way the Communist Party was. It gave up. It officially renounced its aim to take control of Japan by a militant or a violent revolution, and also it was pro-Soviet and things like that, which after what happened in Hungary was also heavily criticized by people on the left. So it was quite a painful experience. But the new left, the left in Japan, began to split, and this new left emerged, and these were quite traumatic experiences. So people broke away from the Communist Party, and the Communist Party became an enemy. So now for these new left groups, there were many enemies. There was of course the nation state, the Japan, and the imperialist state, also capitalism, also the far right, the ultra nationalists, but also the Communist Party. So the old left was as much an enemy as the other enemies. And this is a very, very difficult division in the left, and that has never really healed. Exactly where we define, where and when we define the new left in Japan is a little bit difficult, and some people have different opinions. But the first groups emerged in the 50s, but many people start talking about the new left seriously from about the mid-60s onwards. And the Japanese word for new left became common and became famous at the end of the 60s. And that's when definitely the new left, like in other countries, was the dominant force in the social movements.
Yeah, I think we can come back to the new left-wing movement and also to the specific groups of the new left. First, I would like to talk about the students who are maybe also a part of this new left-wing movement. One thing that happened in the most countries in this year, 1968, was the protest of the students. The students protested against their specific situation in the society, and they started to discuss the whole education system and the new university system. Also in Japan, there's been a students' movement. How was the situation of the students in the 60s in Japan?
Yes, the student movement was the driving force of the new left in Japan, and in general, most of the social movements in the 60s. The way the period is remembered now as a little bit, maybe a little bit too dominated by the student groups, but because there were also worker groups and non-student groups, but nonetheless, the student groups were the most important. And you kind of see in two main waves. So originally there was, at the end of the 50s and early 60s, a strong movement against the renewal of the security treaty between America, United States, and Japan. And the treaty is called AMPO. And so this had been signed in 52, but when it came out for renewal, there was a big movement to see it changed, or for the government not to renew it. This was, again, the student movement was very strong in its opposition. And this was a huge movement. There were tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands sometimes on the streets of Japan, particularly Tokyo. And it famously led to one female student was killed during the protests. And that was sort of seen as the very much the climax of the movement in 1960. And then there's a second sort of wave of student groups towards the end of the 60s. And this point now, I mean, like in other countries, the student population began to increase by a lot. Many, many new students were joining universities because the population had risen. And they were finding a lot of problems. One, of course, was the political problems, but also just in general, the universities, they were very angry about the facilities, what they were paying for, and the kind of situation they had where they were this very hierarchical relationship between the professors and the students. So there was a reaction against that. Also, the national universities, it was seen as they were part of the imperialist state as well. And then at the private universities, there was seen as corruption with the use of the money of the universities. So some of the campuses began to experience strikes and occupations of the buildings from the late 60s onwards. Some of these were about local issues, but quite quickly they began to take on much bigger meanings and began to see each other as a national movement. And so the campus movements that were established at each university tried to join together and form a single national movement at the end of the 60s. And unfortunately, it didn't last very long. They had one famous, very large rally in Tokyo at the end of the 60s. But you can see that although the campus movements were spread around different universities, they were also trying to form a single large movement. And it's from these students that a lot of the new left groups found their recruits. And so the students were, first of all, protesting on the campus and not going to classes for, you know, a whole year. And then the riot police were coming onto campus, and there were, you know, battles between students and police on campus. But also then the new left groups were taking the students out of the campuses and onto the streets to protest in other movements, anti-war movement, anti-Vietnam War, against the occupation of Okinawa, and so on.
So one of the radical left students groups was called the Sengakuren. They became very famous. They are also known in other countries, not only in Japan. The Sengakuren, they have been found in 1948, but then in the 60s, they started to split so that there existed five groups that called themselves Sengakuren. Can you tell us something about the Sengakuren and the dynamic of this group?
Yes, Sengakuren, it's very, very complicated. Basically, it's easier to think about it as a federation or a kind of network of different student groups. So the student groups were formed at universities. For example, student clubs or faculties had an independent, self-running, self-organized group. And this would be affiliated with Sengakuren, which was originally a national movement. But when there was the first split between the Communist Party and the New Left in the 50s, already within the Sengakuren, there were some groups that were claiming to be supporters of the Communist Party and their youth group. And others were saying, no, we are supporting this new group that came called the Bund. So already there was, very early on, there was actually a split, even before the 60s. And then after the first Security Treaty, the AMPOR movements in 1960, again, it collapsed even more. And then basically Zain Grakadin stops being a kind of national movement. And instead, it's dominated by different factions, so different New Left groups and their affiliated student councils and student groups, all claiming to be Zain Grakadin. So maybe the most interesting thing is that quite early on, Zain Grakadin was a very militant and aggressive and energetic force. It was one of the leading forces campaigning against the U.S. military bases in Japan from the, you know, from the 50s onwards. So it already had its very, very strong reputation as a kind of rebellious, antisocial, anti-authoritarian group from very early on. And that got stronger and stronger until even now today, the name Zain Grakadin has all these kind of associations, quite negative associations. But I mean, actually, who really is Zain Grakadin is a bit complicated. So during the 60s, different factions started to link together for certain protests and certain struggles. So then you have, then Zain Grakadin becomes almost a national group again. But, I mean, officially, it's three or four different groups who are each calling themselves Zain Grakadin because they have different factions. But they are trying to link together and form a national movement. But unfortunately, it was never really able to become truly national again like it was originally. And today, Zain Grakadin still exists, actually. There are some groups that still use the name, and probably most famously is the youth group of what's called the Central Core Factions, the Chukakuha. Their student group, Zain Grakadin, is actually very active today. It's obviously quite small numbers, but they are quite active at Kyoto University and some other universities around Japan. And they often appear in the Japanese media, the Japanese press. So there is quite a lot of interest in them still, and they're doing some interesting things. While their ideology is still quite fixed in 1670s mentality, but they are trying to adapt and use new kinds of ways to appeal to young people today.
Beside the Sengakuren, there existed some other left-wing students groups in Japan, for example, the Beihiren. I don't know if I pronounce it right. Beihiren, maybe you know it. What can you tell us about
Beihiren? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What can you tell us about them, maybe also in difference to the Sengakuren?
Yes, Beihiren people tend to, when they said the New Left, again, we think a lot about students, but actually groups like Beihiren were also part of the New Left because it was a new kind of left-wing movement. Beihiren was very loose. It was very decentralized. It was a group founded as an anti-war group. It was against the Vietnam War. And they organized some very, very large protests and rallies in Tokyo and elsewhere around Japan. It was associated with many famous people, many famous intellectuals and writers, and it was very easy to make your own local Beihiren group. So that meant it became very quickly, it spread around the country. And it was very good at spreading information as well. So it was a huge information network. It's obviously long before the days of, you know, the internet. And there was a group like Beihiren was very important for forming networks of information around Japan. And this was also very useful because the group was engaged in some illegal activities or some activities which were semi-illegal, let's say. For example, it was helping American soldiers to desert. So they were in their military bases in Japan and they were going to be sent to Vietnam. Beihiren was helping these soldiers to go AWOL, to leave their bases and to be hidden in Japan somewhere for a while and then taken by boat out of Japan to somewhere like Sweden and going via Russia and Europe. And so Beihiren had actually a network of people around the country, but also around the world of Beihiren activists and supporters who were helping to escort these American soldiers or ex-soldiers to neutral countries. And so that's one of the most famous things they did, actually, in addition to the large-scale protests.
When we talk about 1968 in France, for example, you can see that the month May has been the most important month, the famous Parisian May 1968. I heard in Japan it was the October. In October there happened very intensive fights between students and police, and also the workers started to become a part of this conflict. There's the keyword of the attack of Tokyo. Can you tell us what happened in October 1968?
Yes, I mean, Japan also has these sort of famous dates and famous events where there was a climax or a famous confrontation, but it is more spread out. There's several of them rather than just one. So one of them is, yeah, October 21st, the famous International Anti-War Day protest. But actually, again, it wasn't just 68. It happened the next year in 69 as well. And so both times there was a very large street protest in Tokyo, which became riots, and there was a lot of destruction and a lot of disruption of trains and stations, and a lot of damage to property, and hundreds of arrests and lots of injuries as well. And the driving force was, again, these new left groups who were mostly students. There were also some workers involved. There was one quite famous anti-war worker group, which attracted quite a lot of young people, young workers, who were, some of them about the same age as the students, but they were not actually at universities. But also the major labor unions also on this day held rallies, officially peaceful ones as well. But other than the October, the famous October riot in 68 and 69, there are also many other famous incidents. So it's hard to find a single key month or a single key day. But, for example, in January 68, there was very famous riots in the south of Japan because an American submarine was visiting, as an American aircraft carrier was visiting, and lots of students went down there, and there was large confrontations with police. And likewise, at the beginning of 69, January 69, there was very, very famous confrontation between thousands of riot police and many students at the University of Tokyo, which is the most famous and most prestigious university in Japan. And this was the kind of climax or grand finale of the student movement at University of Tokyo, where they'd been occupying parts of the campus for a long time on a student strike. And finally, because it's a national university, they said enough is enough, and they sent in the riot police. And I mean, probably the most famous images of this period in Japan would be of the main hall at the University of Tokyo, whilst just completely surrounded by police with water cannons. And the halls are the windows and everything is covered in flags of the left wing student groups. So this was it was a very famous media incident. People watched it on television at the time, and it was very destructive. The university was basically smashed and heavily damaged, and they had to cancel the entrance exams for the next academic year. So that was seen as a very, very, very landmark event in the movement. But actually, it happened in 69, not in 68. So sometimes this sort of the language becomes a little bit unclear, really. When you say 1968 in Japan, you also kind of mean 69 as well. There was a lot of overlap.
From what you said, and also from what I read about 1968 in Japan, it seems to me as if the confrontation between the new left groups and the police and the state was very intensive, very militant. You also said that the Sengakuren was a very militant group, and yeah, to me it seems that it was very violently. And is that a right impression? And maybe the reasons why it was so violently. Also later in the 70s, when the armed groups became a part of the movement, it has very violent dynamic. Is that right?
Yes, I mean, it was violent. You can't deny that. I think sometimes people from that generation or people who are part of the movement sometimes don't like to talk about this, but undeniably it was violent, and many people did die. So a lot of the first people who died were student protesters, actually, who were killed by accidents in the crowd, most famously in 1960, but also there were several others later on in the 60s. Also, some riot police also died, you know, for example, by accidents. I think that one of the real reasons it was violent, well, firstly, well, there was this, yeah, the state versus the student groups or the new left groups, and that was violent. But then also there was, between the left-wing groups, there was fighting as well. So there was the Communist Party group fighting against some of the new left groups, and then even more so, the new left groups started to fight amongst themselves. And this was violent. This was violent fairly early on, but it got more and more violent from the end of the 60s and into the 70s. There are several reasons why that. I mean, one of the things is the pressure. There was so much pressure on these activists. Like I said, there were thousands of police surrounding some of these campuses sometimes. And so the only way to not be, to be arrested is to fight back. You know, it was very difficult to get your message across otherwise. You'd just be lost and you'll be arrested and you'll be out of, you know, the Japanese legal system is quite harsh and you could be arrested and held without trial for a long time. It wasn't the case where you could, you know, continue to communicate with people. You'll be gone from public sight. So I think people sometimes saw, you know, it was almost like a fight to the death sometimes. You basically, if you get arrested, that's it, you're out. You're out for several years at least. I think there was a sense of pressure and desperation. But then it got worse because of all the defeats. You know, when you've been defeated, it makes you more angry. And certain groups react in different ways. And so then other groups were blaming each other for the way they were acting. You know, calling each other, you are a traitor. You did not stay to the end of that particular fight. You know, there was this sort of tit-for-tat accusations between the different groups, and that escalated the violence from basically 1969 onwards, and we started to see a lot of infighting, and most of the people who died are actually these new left groups killing each other, actually, although there were some police deaths as well, and some deaths of protesters by police. Actually, the majority of deaths were between student groups. And that had a very, very negative impact upon the whole movement. The new recruits were put off because these groups seemed more and more extremist and more isolated from each other. And so it created a very negative impression about the whole movement. And that has lasted until today. Even now, people have a negative impression of these groups because of what happened really actually afterwards. But they kind of don't realize the history is a little bit confused now. And people tend to think mostly about what happened after the peak of the protests, actually. And they forget that, you know, it wasn't always so violent.
I would like to talk about the topics of the movements in the 60s again. From what you said, one of the most important topics was the Vietnam War, of course. It was a worldwide protest against the Vietnam War. And also very important was the protest against that Japan supported the USA in the bloc confrontation. So as a first question, these two topics, was they the most important topics, or have there been also other topics who was important for the movement?
Well, there were many, many issues and many topics became important at different times. And also some of these topics became kind of conflated. They kind of joined together. And if you actually unpack them, you can see several topics, but they would often be kind of, the protests would join them all together, because they seemed at the time to be almost the same big issue. So the Vietnam War, the war issue, is a case in point, because if you protest the Vietnam War in the late 60s in Japan, you are protesting actually many things. You are protesting the security treaty between Japan and America. You are protesting the presence of the US military bases in Japan. You are protesting the continued occupation of Okinawa by the United States. You're protesting the way the Japanese government is allowing America to use Japanese property and Japanese resources as part of the war in Vietnam. You know, planes were taking off from Okinawa to bomb Vietnam. So there was Japan was basically, even though it had an anti-war constitution, was actually part of this war machine. Even, for example, the protests against Narita Airport, this was not just about the farmers and their land being taken from them. At the time, people associated with the airport construction with developing another facility that could be used for war, you know, for planes coming in and then going off to bases or flying off to the war zone. And so even that protest was part of something much bigger. I mean, there were other some more isolated issues as well. For example, one of the big issues in the middle of the 60s was about the treaty between South Korea and Japan, where they normalized relations again. And it's actually still a problem today, because at the time, South Korea, you know, was not a regular democratic country. And so people saw the treaty as not really settling the problems of Japan's war legacy. And so today, actually, one of the main reasons there are still problems in South Korea and Japan is because of this treaty, actually, and how the things it did not do and things it did do. So that was, for example, a slightly more isolated movement in the middle of the 60s. But in general, as you study this period in Japan, more and more, a lot of these movements, a lot of the issues kind of overlap and become one. And there's a certain amount of confusion about that as well.
I think for us here in our talk, it's only possible to give a little overview about what happened in Japan in 1968 and in the 60s to set some spotlight. So for us, it's not really possible to follow the development then after 1968 after. But maybe as a last question, in the Western countries, 1968 became kind of a symbol that marks a series of changes that happened then. Did 1968 also change Japan, and in which way did it?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question, and it's a really big one as well, and something I think a lot about. It's in some ways it's easy to answer, some ways it's difficult to answer. I mean, easy to answer is yes, because, you know, today the generation who are now basically about retiring age all have some direct connection with what happened. You know, they either participated or they observed directly or through television what happened. And it was seen as a very much the climax of the youth movement in Japan. And it's sometimes looked back on with nostalgia as an exciting time. And there's a lot of, you know, films and books about this. And, you know, people have memories about their student strike. So it's definitely a huge cultural event which left a large mark on a whole generation. And some of it very positive. But it becomes more complicated when we see that afterwards, the student movement, the New Left movement, began to decline quite rapidly. And that was for many reasons, the violence, for example, but also the way that the state and the police were reacting to the groups and putting a lot of pressure on them to put them into decline. And there was a new law was passed, which also allowed police to go onto campuses more easily and break up student strikes. So in some ways, it's very much a turning point because it marked the time when the nation state, the state, turned around and said, okay, enough is enough. We won't let this happen anymore. And of course, it's not as simple as that. Actually, many movements did continue and it didn't all suddenly stop. But there was definitely a point where, you know, there's a very, very large youth population. And today, Japan's population is in decline. Young people is going down. But at the time, the number of young people was very, very high in Japan. And they were basically, you know, thousands and thousands of them were aspiring and aiming towards certain causes. And they were basically stopped by the state, either at university level or these sort of national protests, these large protests and riots. And they were basically, you know, they couldn't succeed, they couldn't win. And I think that's had a very strong impact upon people. And it's one of the reasons why I think people are quite cynical now about politics in Japan. And although, of course, some people are do try, and lots of opposition parties and lots of political groups, and including some young ones, I think that the overall legacy of 68-69 is that of failure, of defeat. And I think that's very hard for regular people to see beyond. And I think it's one of the reasons why today, you know, there isn't much politics of hope in Japan. It's not like we're seeing in other countries where charismatic leaders on left and on the left and the liberal side can emerge easily. You know, it basically doesn't happen very much in Japan. Very much the conservative groups have managed to stay in power almost the entire period since the end of the war. And I think one of the reasons for that is this failure of the movements and the way now it's remembered primarily as a failure.
Yeah, when you talk about the remembrance, it's a very interesting question, because in Germany this year, in the public, there was a big focus on 1968. So it's the fifth anniversary of 50 years after 1968. Many books has been released here in Germany, many lectures and articles about 1968. Is it also a topic in the media in Japan?
Yes, very much so. Lots of exhibitions and events and books and so on have been appearing. But not only because of the 50th anniversary of 68, actually. This remembering, this process of re-remembering, let's say, has been ongoing, actually, for about 10 or more years, actually. In Japan, there's been a large increase in the number of books and documentaries and TV programs and exhibitions and events, you know, symposia, etc., etc., you know, since basically 2000s. I think maybe this is because there isn't a single, it wasn't only 68. Like I said before, there are several other key events that are in different times. So maybe that's why the process of remembering is spread over several years rather than just one year. And I think also it's because the generation that were involved, of course, are getting older and approaching retirement age. And so they are getting nostalgic and writing books and want to appear in public and tell people about what happened. But this process of remembering has been ongoing, and I hope it continues as well, because you know, for a long time people did not talk about it, actually. And for a long time there was books and information, but it was not so mainstream. And so it's wonderful to see an explosion of information and discourse about the movement. Some of it, of course, not so accurate, some of it a little bit biased maybe, but it's wonderful to see this discussion happening, and I hope it continues.